What I want to do is talk to you about two different experiences that I had, two different weeks that I spent as a youth leader back in the day at First Baptist Church, back in the zeros, the aughts, whatever we call those. And it's good to see some of my old youth group kids here. The first week I want to tell you about is a summer trip that we went on called Young Life. And many of you have heard of the Young Life organization. They run camps all around the country. And the one that we had the opportunity to go to was in a place called Rockbridge, Virginia. And we took our group down there. The first time we went, we took about 10 students, and the next time we took about 40, and the last time I think we took 70 students down to Rockbridge. And I just want to read the description of the Rockbridge camp to you. It says, during 1 week at Rockbridge, you can experience the ropes course, the obstacle course, the climbing tower, the swing, the zip line, the giant water slide, the pool, hot tub, blob, mountain bikes, indoor gym, weight room, outdoor basketball courts, sand volleyball, 18-hole frisbee golf course, soccer, lacrosse, football, game room. And when you need a break from all those activities, you can relax with your friends by taking in the view from the Spring Center porch or enjoying a shake or coffee at the snack bar. That sounds exhausting. Just that list of things sounds exhausting, doesn't it? And so what's the point of all this fantasticness that Young Life puts on? They are an outreach organization. And what they try to do is get folks to come to camp over the summer. And over the 5 nights that they're at camp, the gospel is presented. And it really is an amazing experience to watch students have their eyes open to who Jesus is. And on the next to last night, they invite students to take 15 minutes and to make a decision about where they stand on this man named Jesus. And they actually hand out a nail, because it's the night that they preach on the crucifixion, and I still have that nail. I did my own arts and crafts, that's why it's so ugly, from A.C. Moore, and I can still wear this from decision night. But it really is advertised. If you read the rest of their brochure, it says, kids consistently tell us that Young Life Camp is the best week of their life. And in a lot of ways, I would agree. In a lot of ways, those 3 weeks we spent at Young Life were some of the best of my life. But before I tell you about the second week that I spent as a youth leader, I want to focus in on what we've been talking about, which is our topic for tonight. If you're joining us for the first time, if you're a visitor, if you haven't been here in a while, we welcome you, and we're so glad you're here. My mommy is here tonight. Hi, mommy. We are in the middle of a series called The Community Jesus Intends. And on the first week, Christian gave us a quick overview, and we heard basically about the fact that there is a way that Jesus intends for us to do community. And that way is very different than the community that the world promotes. If the world even promotes community anymore, I know the world's become a very, not ruggedly, but radically individualistic place. And the second sermon we heard last week was about the way we can welcome one another. Welcome each other and welcome people who are visiting with us for the first time. And so this week we're going to be talking about what it looks like to serve one another. And so the verse we're going to be focusing in on, there it is Galatians 5. It's up on the screen, or if you want to pick up your pew Bibles, you can take a look at it. I want to give you a little bit of background before we read these two verses. The book of Galatians is a letter from a guy named Paul to churches in an area called Galatia, and there was some controversy in the church at Galatia. You see, there were two groups of people who belonged to this church. There were people who had converted to the way. Now, Christians didn't call themselves Christians at the time. They were followers of the way. So there were some folks that had converted to the way, or started following the way, that had been Jewish. And there were other folks who were following the way that had been Gentiles. And now the Jews were basically bullying the Gentiles, and they were forcing the Gentiles to adopt the traditions and the regulations that they had followed as Jews. And so Paul writes a response to this. And he says, you, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free. But do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. So if you look at the first half of that verse 13, you see it's a summation of basically the previous 5.5 chapters, which were all about all the ways that we are supposed to be free. The second half of 13, it's easy to read this wrong or to pull this out of context. It says, but do not use your freedom to indulge the flesh. All us rules-driven Christians love to read those verses about the flesh and think things like, you know, don't indulge the flesh, don't curse, or go to bars and you will be saved. But that's not at all what I think what Paul is trying to say here. And at first glance, verse 14 looks like the most remarkable spark notes ever. Paul sums up 613 rules with one line. That's pretty impressive. That saves you a lot of homework. And he says, basically, the 613 rules can be summed up as what we call the golden rule. And in some ways, Paul definitely has done a very remarkable job of summing it up. But I think if we back out of this for a moment, we see there's a lot more going on here. First, I think we need to take a look at some of the things that Jesus means when he says that his people are supposed to be free. If it's freedom that we're supposed to be leveraging to service, then first we have to ask, well, what does it look like to be free? Or what does it look like to not be free? And I think there are three things that stand out in what Paul was responding to that the Judaizers, as they were called, were not letting the Gentiles be free from. The rules, the world, and the past. And we'll start with the rules. For folks who think that following Jesus is about following a set of rules, this letter is bad news. While there are rules that God designs for our benefit, they function like rules in every area of life. You think about sports. The rules are not the point of the game. The rules are designed to protect the players while they play the game. But the point of the game is always something much bigger. The point of soccer, the winner of a soccer match, is not the team that has accumulated the fewest yellow cards or red cards. It's the team that scores the most goals. In the same way, the rules are designed to protect us while we play the game of life, but they are not the point of life. Jesus also calls us to be free from the world. As a high school teacher, I'm totally drawn to this quote by T.S. Eliot. He says, "Half the harm that is done in this world is due to people who want to feel important. They don't mean to do harm, but the harm does not interest them. Or they do not see it, or they justify it because they are absorbed in the endless struggle to think well of themselves." So I say to you tonight that God created you, and Jesus thought that you were worth dying for, so you have no reason to not think well of yourself, if those two have already thought that of you. In high school, I hear at least once a week, I hear a high school student say, this is my favorite, "I don't care what anybody thinks about me." Let me translate that for you. I think that people who don't care what other people think are cool, so I'm going to tell you that I don't care what you think about me, because I know that's going to sound impressive. I think that's basically how "I don't care what anybody thinks about me" translates when I hear it at work. But Jesus calls us to be free from the opinions of other people, to be free from the opinions of the world. And lastly, Jesus calls us to be free from our past. Many of us are defined by the hurts or the guilt or the brokenness from which we cannot or choose not to be free. In Philippians 3, in the Message translation, Paul says, "I'm not saying that I have it all together, that I have it all made. But I am well on my way, reaching out for Christ who has so wondrously reached out for me. Friends, don't get me wrong. By no means do I count myself an expert in all of this, but I've got my eye on the goal where God is beckoning me forward to Jesus. I'm off and running, and I'm not turning back." Jesus calls us to be free from the past and to stop spending so much time and energy running or trying to make the wrongs right. And we can stop searching for the thing that we feel we were robbed of in our circumstances or in the way that people treated us, and we can get unstuck from the guilt that sometimes can paralyze us, and we can start to trust and we can start to give again. And while you could easily do a message or a whole sermon series probably on each one of these types of slavery, slavery to the rules and slavery to the world, I think that we need to focus tonight on the role that slavery plays in service. Or to sum it up, what does unfree service look like, and what does free service look like? And what's the difference, and why does it matter to us? What we're looking at here are the motivations for service. We're looking at the right reasons to do the right thing. These motivations that will allow us to do this serving thing continually and indefinitely, and most importantly, joyfully. So let's look at what unfree service might look like. If our master is the rules, then we serve out of obligation. Now, this is tricky because there are a lot of things that we are supposed to do that we should be doing. But there are a few things that we shouldn't be doing them. These are the things that we do out of obligation. And it's tough to think of examples of these because I don't want to exonerate anybody from something that they're doing. They're like, "Ha, he said I don't have to do that anymore," because I don't know what God's calling you in particular to do. But things that popped into my mind were the people who are like, "All right, I'm the organized one, I'll run it." Or, "I have a lot of free time, so I'll do it." And people who serve out of obligation are not necessarily doing what they're called to do, they're doing what they're supposed to do.
And the problem with this is that if you serve out of obligation, you become very aware of everybody who's not pulling their weight. And that can make you very resentful and eventually angry. If your master is the world, you serve because of appearances. We get out front and we do things to impress people. Right?
As a high school teacher, I walk into any club meeting in high school and I ask the students, why did you join this club? Do you want to make a difference? And they say, no, of course not. I wanted to look good on my college application. And this goes into the world of grown-ups for all the folks who get involved in community activities more as a way to network their business than as a way to serve other people. So we grown-ups are not out of the woods on this one yet. And we do this relationally as well, don't we? When I'm serving my wife and she doesn't notice, man, I am all... She's got about 15 minutes from when she walks home to figure out what I've done around the house and to compliment me on it, or it's going to be trouble. I'm like...
Floors are looking pretty clean, aren't they?
Somebody must have vacuumed, huh? Or the baby's got a dry diaper. Didn't change that herself, did she? And we serve... because the world is our master. And this creates the danger of two opposite results. One, if the world's not watching or giving us the pat on the back, we stop serving. Or two, and I have to quote C.S. Lewis every time I'm up here, if you've noticed, for those of you that are consistently here. He says this, if we serve because the world is watching, we become prideful. And he says, the trouble begins when you pass from thinking, I have pleased this person and all is well, to thinking, what a fine person I must be having done it. The more you delight in yourself and the less you delight in the action, the worse you are becoming. The vain person wants praise, applause, admiration, and is always angling to get it. If your master is the past, you might serve out of guilt or out of brokenness. Now, this is the trickiest one right here, because there's nothing inherently wrong with this kind of service. Having the opportunity to make amends for your past is a grace. So don't hear me wrong. There are people who descended into addiction, and they got well, and now they're a sponsor. And that is a great way to serve out of your past. Right? There are people who watched Spider-Man, and they heard that to whom much is given, much will be expected. And so they're out there doing the much that is expected. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. There is immeasurable good done in this world because of brokenness. Goodness, just go to a Relay for Life and see all the people who are serving because of the brokenness that cancer has brought into their life. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But while it is entirely possible that a person that is not free from the past and one who is free from the past, they might end up doing the same type of service. But the point is that you're supposed to be free from your past, not running from it, and not working to fix it, free from it. Because in the end, service done from slavery to the past can lead to exhaustion or a feeling that the deeds didn't fix the hurt and were therefore done in vain. So that brings us to the question for tonight. What does service done from freedom look like? And how do we get started on this life of service and freedom? Let me start with the second question first. Most people here, but not all of you certainly, have taken the first step in this. And that's to enter into a relationship with Jesus Christ. Through his crucifixion, he means to drive nails through the tethers that tie you to the past and to the world and to the rules. And if you're here tonight and you rightly are evaluating Christians from the outside and saying, I know lots of those Christians that are not free from those things, please listen to this. This type of freedom is the result of a journey, not a jailbreak. This is more like the 40 years the Israelites spent in the wilderness getting free from these things, not the miraculous earthquake that loosened the shackles on Paul that happens overnight. So if you have entered into this relationship and acknowledged and accepted what Jesus has done, what then? What does this life of service through faith look like? And I started thinking about the Bible's teaching on tithing. And there's this idea that you're supposed to give the first 10% or the best 10% of what you have to God. And I was like, well, that's it. It's not fill your 90% of your life with busyness and then shoehorn in a big act of service in the 10% that's left that you become really resentful of because you're like, that's the 10% that I want to be relaxing. And now I'm serving because I'm supposed to serve because it's the 10%. All right, that is probably not what God intended when he was talking about a life of service. In fact, he's not talking about this 10% or that 10%. It's much more frightening than that. He's talking about service that permeates the whole thing. In fact, this passage, the part where it talks about serving, that word they use is actually translated as slavery in other parts of the New Testament. We're supposed to be slaves to one another. That's scary stuff. That's not part-time work or a separate work. That's a life's work. And I'd say without being free, that type of work is utterly impossible. So if we're on the journey of breaking free from the past and the rules and the world, and we're convinced that service is a life's work and not an extracurricular activity, what then? Well, as anybody who doesn't preach full-time does when they have to preach on a certain topic, I Googled, you know, old sermons and commentaries on this verse, and because that's what you have to do. Why reinvent the wheel? And I came across Martin Luther's commentary. Now, he's kind of a big deal, right? He started this whole Protestant thing going. So he said about this verse, he said, "Let everybody perform the duties of his station and vocation diligently and help his neighbor to the limit of his capacity." Okay. Well, what's your station? I'd say your station is wherever you are and whatever you have at this point in your life. Service is not the exclusive domain of those who have extra. It's not just the rich who should be giving away their money or the retired who should be giving away their time. You can serve no matter where you are. If you're married, begin to see your spouse as a person that you freely choose to be a slave to. And watch what that does for your marriage. Not for a day or for a week, but for a while. And I guarantee it would change. I would never try this, but I'm sure it would change things.
If you're a student, begin to see your classmates not as people you compete with, but people that you can help. If you're in your 20s, begin to see dating not for what you can get out of her, but for what you can give to her. And if you're a regular attender of this church, ask yourself, am I a consumer or a server? If you're a consumer, as I was for many years at churches I've attended, the only time that you think about church in the 166 and a half hours between services is to evaluate the last service. Well, the music was pretty good, but the sermon was pretty bad. Right? If that's all that's happening in the 166 hours in between, you might need a perspective change on your relationship with your local church. On my desk at work, I have one framed quote, and it's a quote by Helen Keller that says this, and I'll leave this as our summation of what we can do with our station. It says, "I long to accomplish a great and noble task, but it is my chief duty to accomplish small tasks as if they were great and noble." Whatever your station, serve others by doing small tasks intentionally and enthusiastically. Vocation. How can we use our vocation? Well, one complaint I think that Christians make is, well, I don't understand how the Sunday thing relates to the other 5 days of the week thing. Or how do we bring the Sunday thing to the other 5 days of the week thing? And I think that's a legitimate complaint. That is a tough... I'm a public school teacher. I'm barred by law from talking about a lot of things that I would like to talk about. So let me just say a couple things about vocation. One, every job is a type of service. And two, you can take a servant's heart out of every type of job. It's easy to say that ministers and teachers and healthcare professionals are the ones who can serve at work. But I can assure you that there are lots of teachers who have taken all the service out of the job that they have at my school. And there are many people who work elsewhere, in offices and on job sites, who find creative ways to be servants to the people around them, even though they're not in service-type work. I remember Deb Lutzema coming up here talking about all the ways that she ministers to people at a fragrance company as a corporate executive and telling us the ways that she does that. So there are creative ways to do that, no matter what your line of work. So let me just say this. I'm an adult convert. When I first became a Christian right after college, I worked at the admissions office at my alma mater, Wake Forest. And I worked with a guy named Colin Creel, who was one of the assistant directors of admissions. And he became my friend and my roommate and my mentor as I was new to this whole thing. And he told me this. At work, no matter what kind of job it is, my job was to, you know, ruin kids' lives and reject them from Wake Forest, you know, wreck their dreams. He said, no matter what your job is, here's the rule. People over agenda unconditionally. So now that I am a teacher, I try to bring that to school with me, and the one thing I try to do every day is I don't go to the faculty room. And I don't not go to the faculty room because they gossip and complain all the time. I gossip and complain outside the faculty room, so it's not necessarily the exclusive domain of the faculty room. I stay not in the faculty room, and I don't go anywhere else that I could hide and get all my work done, get all my papers graded and my grades entered and my lesson plans done. I stay right in open classrooms because I want kids to be able to find me. Because it's people over agenda unconditionally. And kids, they do find me.
And the problem now after teaching for 15 years isn't so much that I don't know what to do with the stories I hear, it's that I've heard every story 100 times. But the person telling it to me is experiencing it for the first. So it's become really hard to not be like, oh, everybody's ex-girlfriend's crazy when you're in high school. Everybody. But it's my job, it's to hear them out and to make them feel heard, and it's my act of service to not be dismissive about their problem and to make sure that they know that there's someone who cares. So my station, my vocation, that's a good start. Well, what else? Is that all there is to it? I heard that if you want to understand what the New Testament says, then look at what Jesus does. And so we heard a reading before the moment of silence of Jesus and what he did for his disciples at the Last Supper. And it says, the evening meal was in progress. Now listen carefully to this. The devil had already prompted Judas to betray Jesus. Jesus knew the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus replied, you do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand. When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I have done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I say to you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is any messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. You see, Jesus has the station, Master, Lord. But he uses that station not to rule, but to die. And he has the vocation, teacher, they call me. But he uses that vocation to bring people in, not to push people away. And then on top of that, in this small group of people that he was doing life with, the church, if you will, his small group, his D group, whatever we're going to call them here, he said, we have to find ways to serve each other. And he finds completely unexpected ways to do that, going so far as to wash his disciples' feet. And maybe that is our most important call to service of all. On top of station and vocation, it's to serve one another, to take care of one another. And by serving the community of Jesus, perhaps we create the community that Jesus intends. You see, you all, we all, have something very valuable. We can call it spiritual gifts. We can go to Romans 12 or do whatever we want to do. But the bottom line is this. You have something valuable, and it's too good to keep for yourself. You need to figure out what it is, and you need to give it away. Lastly, this church for now is still called Outreach Red Bank. And so the question is, well, how, if we're all so busy serving each other, how do we do outreach then? Will we have any time left to do that? And I would say this. I'm sure that you've heard, I hear it all the time as a high school teacher, that people, the young people today, you know what they have very acutely? A sense of entitlement. Have you heard this? Have you heard people, young people told me they have a sense of entitlement? Now, I usually don't like to get involved in this intergenerational grenade throwing that goes on because old people always think that they're better than young people, and I get whatever, that's fine. But I think I figured out what sense of entitlement actually means, and I'm going to bring it up tonight because I don't think that young people are the only ones that have it. I think a sense of entitlement is the willingness to take more out of something than you're going to put into it. And maybe it starts with parents who treat their kids like they're the center of the universe. Who knows? It doesn't matter. But all I know is that it bleeds into, your sense of entitlement bleeds into your friendships and your relationships and ultimately into the way that you treat community. And if things don't go your way when you have a sense of entitlement, or if the thing has the audacity to ask for something in return, then it's time for head for the exits, right? In Philippians 2, it says, do everything without grumbling or arguing so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation, and then you will shine among them like stars in the sky. It is really, really easy to cherry pick these verses and to focus in on, if I become pure, then I will stand apart from the wicked and depraved generation that's out there, and somehow that's going to be outreach. I don't know how by holding to a set of rules that other people don't even claim to begin to believe in the first place is going to be your great act of, or my great act of outreach. Maybe Paul is saying, and if you look at the whole context of it, something very different. Because he goes on to say, and then I will be able to boast on the day of Christ that I did not run or labor in vain. But even if I am being poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and service coming from your faith, I am glad and rejoice with all of you. So you too should be glad and rejoice with me. Perhaps what Paul is saying is that being poured out and serving one another without grumbling or arguing, that's the thing that's supposed to make us shine like stars in this entitled generation. And maybe the verse for tonight, but do not use your freedom to indulge your flesh. Rather serve humbly in love. Maybe this is not a salvo in the culture wars. It isn't one of our favorite pointing fingers verses, all you flesh followers out there. Maybe it's simply a warning to us that because we're saved, don't follow your flesh. Don't get lazy in your service, because your flesh ain't going to want to do it. But maybe it's your job to continue to do it. Get over yourself, and you and your community will never be better. If we can get this thing right, not even with everyone, but with each other, then maybe the world will come to the edge and peek in on what we're doing here at Outreach Red Bank, and at least maybe they'll say, I don't agree with those people, but look at the way they take care of each other. And then maybe they'll take the next step and they'll say in the marketplace, you know, I don't agree with those people, but I'd sure like to do business with them, the way they handle things. I'd like to work for one or hire one. And maybe in the community they would say, I'd like that guy to be the head of my kids' little league team. Or I'd like my kids to be friends with his kids. And maybe in relationships they'll say, you know, I wouldn't mind if my daughter or my son dated one of those people. They're really nice to each other. It's pretty cool. And maybe that is how we can use service to each other as outreach to the broader community, not just by serving the broader community. Though we should be doing that too. Two more points and I'll be through. One, how is it that we can become sidetracked from this life of service? And I think the story that Christian told last week about the prodigal son gives us some insights into how it's very easy to get sidetracked from a life of service. The prodigal son goes off, he does his thing, and who's at home being the responsible older brother? And then the responsible older brother says, this isn't fair, I've been here the whole time slaving for you, and now he gets the party and I get nothing. And I would say that the first thing that we can get from this is that the brother was keeping score. One quick way to get sidetracked from a life of service is to start keeping score. You'll start resenting the people who aren't serving as much, and you'll open the door to making excuses because other people aren't doing as much. Just realize that it's not about keeping score, because the final score doesn't matter. It's either well done, my good and faithful servant, or it's not. And the other is the verse we read about Jesus washing his disciples' feet. Did you notice how it starts? Judas had already betrayed Jesus, yet he decides to wash their feet anyway. And that should tell us that it's not about the results. Service is about the relationship. The first question you should ask is not, is this making any difference? Because guess what? The disciples walked out of the Last Supper, and guess what happened to their feet? They got dirty again. And even the people that Jesus raised from the dead, guess what they are now? They're dead. Newsflash for you.
So the question you should ask is simple. It's not about, is this working? It's, is this what Jesus is calling me to do? Not about the results, but about the relationship that you have with God. And if it is what he's calling you to do, then keep doing it, even if the outcome isn't exactly what you wish.
So in closing, I want to say two more things. I already said that once. I'm just going to keep telling you two more things to keep stringing you along. Let me say this. Writing this sermon, whatever God has given me in the sermon, has been utterly convicting, because I don't do this well at all. This is one of those things, and this I mean this as apolitically as possible. It is really easy to vote for hope and change. It's really hard to go out and create it. So I realize that, please don't look at the messenger in your evaluation of the message tonight, because I know I'm talking completely. And all the times I said you, I meant to say we, and so if I said you a lot, I take that all back, because Good Lord, don't look at me in any of this. And last, I want to tell you about the other camp. We started with Young Life Camp. I want to tell you about the other camp that we attended. It was called Youth Works. And we went twice on this Youth Works trip. The first time we went to a suburb, a really rough suburb of Boston called Lynn. And the lingo, the little the little jingle they sing about Lynn, Massachusetts is, Lynn, Lynn, the city of sin, you never come out the way you went in. To give you an idea of what Lynn, Massachusetts was like. And the second time we went to a Mohawk reservation on the New York-Canada border. And it was a group of, 50 kids, 50 students and a bunch of leaders, and we were all broken into crews. And we took 5 or 6 or 7 students out into the community and we did work. And we worked at homeless shelters and we worked at soup kitchens and we worked in nursing homes and day facilities for the developmentally disabled and for folks with autism. And we ran summer camps for inner city kids and we cleaned and the list goes on and on. And we slept on the floor of a church and there was no zip line. And we cooked all our own meals. And in Lynn, Massachusetts, there was no showers at the church, so we had to walk 3 blocks through the inner city to a Boys and Girls Club that ironically didn't lack warm water, it lacked cold water. So the showers were like 500 degrees. But you know what? And maybe psychologists out there might call this cognitive dissonance or something, but looking back, I'd say that the 2 weeks at Youth Works were more meaningful than the 3 weeks at Young Life. You see, on the last night of Youth Works, the staff members who run the site, you know what they did? They washed our feet, the leaders. And then they said, you know what you guys are doing tonight? You're going to wash your students' feet. I don't know if you've ever seen teenagers that wear flip-flops for a week doing service work, what their feet look like.
It's not a pretty picture.
But we did. We got in there, we rolled up our sleeves, and that night we washed the feet of the students that we spent the week serving with, and we prayed with them. And I would dare say that by the end of that process, there was more water in tears than there was water in those wash basins. And why? Because we didn't spend the week doing what we wanted to do. We didn't even spend the week doing what we were supposed to do. We spent the week doing what we were saved to do. And that makes all the difference. Let us pray.
Heavenly Father, I pray that you don't strike me down for all the ways that I am not a server.
And I thank you for the good word that you've given for me to communicate to this congregation tonight, Lord. And I pray that you would just help us to do it. And for anyone here who hasn't entered into that relationship with you
that leads to freedom from the past or from the world or from the rules, I pray that they would do that tonight. In all the ways that we hold ourselves back from doing that because we keep you at arm's length, I pray that we would stop doing that. I just thank you for everybody who serves in this church already. And I thank you for everyone who's here tonight. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.